This is really the second edition of the book, Finding Deep Joy. The first one came out from Quest as one of those little Quest miniatures about 1984, I think it was. It didn't do extremely well at that time. In fact, went out of print. And that was always a great disappointment to me personally, chiefly because it was simply one of my own favorite books and one that I felt had a message that I was conceited enough to think that the world might need, that we may need a little more joy in this on this planet. The opportunity came, fortunately, to do a new edition of it, much improved and much enhanced, above all with the beautiful and award-winning cover by Dan Doolin. So I'm now very pleased to have it in an even better format. Now, why did I originally think that it was important to write a book, Finding Deep Joy? Well, it kind of followed through on an earlier one, the first Quest book that I did, Finding the Quiet Mind, which was basically about meditation. Meditation is wonderful, and it's tremendously important to be able to still the mind, to quiet it down once in a while, to let it take a vacation and be what it is in itself, pure consciousness or pure thought, quite apart from all of the monkey mind kind of stuff, the modulations of mind, as the Yoga Sutras call it, the feelings and memories and so on that keep racing up and down and around through our consciousness. Because all of this is like waves on the surface of consciousness, but consciousness in itself is, I would say, like the deep ocean beneath the surface waves, simply the substance into which all of these modulations emerge and all of these monkeys swim. But I felt that there was still something, at least in my own experience, that went even further than just quieting the mind. And that was something that emerges when the mind is able to still itself. And that something is what I call deep joy. I'm sure that many of you, like me, have found that in the heart of meditation, when you have truly succeeded, which in itself, of course, is not always an easy task, but have succeeded in quieting the modulations of mind, and consciousness is still and peaceful like the depths of that ocean underneath the waves, that a kind of bliss, a kind of ecstasy, even rapture, can arise. And it's not bliss, rapture, ecstasy, or joy about anything in particular. Thus, it is to be distinguished very much from what we ordinarily call happiness. Happiness, I think, as we usually think of it, is basically a reactive state. We're happy because something good happened to us. You know, we got a job, we made some money, we got somebody to fall in love with us. You know, all kind of things can induce happiness, large or small. Simply getting a present or maybe even going outdoors on a particularly sparkling and beautiful day. And certainly that's wonderful. There's nothing wrong with that kind of happiness. And in fact, I would say that on a deep level, that happiness has certain channels of communication with joy. It comes from the same place, you might say, though it may have a different function in the spectrum of consciousness. But deep joy itself is not reactive. It doesn't come to us just because of something else that came, but it comes of its own nature. I would say of the nature of consciousness itself, that consciousness itself, awareness itself, whether in us or in the stars or the galaxies of the universe as a whole, which is not, of course, our particular kind of consciousness, but is certainly, must be infused through the universe. We are children of the universe. We came out of it. We didn't drop in, as far as I know, from some entirely different sphere. And therefore, whatever is in us, consciousness, mind, joy, must have at least a potential in the rest of the universe, or else where would we have gotten it from? So, in other words, I would say that consciousness is pervasive and that joy is of the nature of consciousness, that it is what consciousness is when it is just able to be itself, to dwell in its own true nature. There are plenty of times when we are unhappy, of course, when joy seems very, very far away. We're caught up in depression, unhappiness, dissatisfaction, frustration, perhaps deep sorrow, all of those things. I do not deny for a moment that often consciousness is affected by these negatives. And I would go on to say, incidentally, that serious depression, clinical depression as they call it, certainly requires more treatment than simply reading a book like this, and I'm not pretending that that is a cure for serious depression or any other mental problem. Rather, it is really a book that is associated with meditation and explores more deeply the state of consciousness that can come in the midst and the depths of meditation. Because the negatives that can affect deep joy, like the happiness that I spoke of, are also basically reactive. They are responses, perhaps appropriate responses, to things that happen to us that come in from outside or are dredged up from memory. You know, so often it seems like if you don't have anything particular to be unhappy about in your outside life and what's going on around you, that unpleasant memories will arise. You will think about what somebody did to me last week or what happened to me when I was 10 years old and things like that. There is plenty that can get in there like a parasite and begin to gnaw away at the happiness and joy in our consciousness. But if all of this can be excluded, and meditation can help, even if it's not a cure-all, if all of this can be excluded, then we get to that state of consciousness which underlies it all, like the depths of the ocean, or to use a different metaphor, like the way the sun is always there, high in the sky, even on a cloudy day when it seems to be obscured, then consciousness can revert to its true state, the state of deep joy. I'd like to read a little bit from just the opening pages of the book to give an impression of how that is approached here, the beginning of chapter 1. To those who see aright, this vast and mysterious universe is as overflowing with joy as the old-fashioned heaven was overbursting with angels. Its stars throb with joy, its radiations hum with it, its dark or glowing nebulae embedded. The dances of the atoms and galaxies are dances of joy. Here below, joy lies hidden deep down at the heart of all things, boulders, trees, dolphins, zebras, and ourselves. Occasionally, joy can be tapped in such a way that we can recognize its presence everywhere. It streams out of its secret places within us to flood the conscious mind with rapture keener than the sharpest grief and wider than any learning. I have experienced moments and hours when such joy has come, sometimes spontaneously and sometimes induced by meditation, for meditation seldom fails sooner or later to release the floodgates of joy and focus its dancing light. In those moments, one is what life tends toward and what being is all about. Those times of joy are not emotional quirks or manic moods. They are life supremely being itself, being what it wants to be, in touch with the being that is its true nature. When this deep joy comes, it is just there, independent of outer events. It is entirely different from being happy about something, like getting a present or completing a successful business deal. It is a pure joy of being that can well up in the most ordinary settings, amid the drudgery of unglamorous work, or while drifting off to sleep, and it can come in meditation or even in a hospital bed or a prison cell. The authenticity of these moments tells us that the universe, deep down, is joy. For at such times we feel closest to the universe and most a part of its material and spiritual nature. Joy is life realizing what its parent, the universe, God if you wish, is, always was, and shall ever be. But so often, I go on to say, we block deep joy. To block joy is our privilege as a finite, particularized children of the universe, but it's an action hardly to our credit. We get caught up in our routines, our little fears and goals. We merely skim the surface of little puddles of joy as we run by, ignoring the vast oceans of it that wash up on the beach of our conscious minds. We may even think that instead of joy, the untapped levels of mind are subcellars full of dirt and dragons. Some forms of psychoanalysis might try to persuade us. If only we knew, and we can know. I talk about our average day, the ups and downs and so on that go through the day, but how sometimes at least, even in the midst of an ordinary day, a flash of joy, just seeing a flight of wild geese in the sky, the light cast by the silver moon just past full, things like that can trigger it, can set it off. And of course, there are things that we can do in our lives also. One thing that I have in this book at the end of each chapter is a kind of exercise and reading. And sometimes these are based on responses that I got from people in various groups to whom I spoke about this subject before actually finishing the book. Sometimes in an audience like this, I would pass around a sheet and ask people to write down just very briefly something like, do you feel are your moments of deepest joy? When do you most feel this kind of deep joy? Something like that. And here are some of the kind of answers that I got. In the early morning, before any clutter enters my mind. When I am in nature and feel at one with a leaf or a blade of grass. When I'm being creative and placing objects so that they are aesthetically pleasing. When I'm doing a good job, feeling competent, even expert at times. Connecting with the right person in the right way. Pausing during a hectic workday to enjoy the blue sky and say thank you. Listening to the birds or the laughter of children. When I'm spending time with a wise elderly woman who lives down the street. Sitting on my porch watching the sunset. When I'm playing hide and seek in the dark with my grandson. In the midst of good friends. Feeling that I truly understand and have been understood by someone I care about. Dancing. Well, that may give you a few ideas for where deep joy is found in the lives of some people, or if not, the fullness of it, at least certain expressions that I would certainly say profoundly connect with it and through inner channels. One thing that was a premise of this book I got from the Vedanta tradition, and that is that there are several sheaths of human nature. We have more or less the equivalent in theosophy. But one thing that particularly interested me in Vedanta is that the inner koshe or sheath next to the Atman or the divine within itself, the first expression of a separate personality, is the Ananda koshe or the sheath of bliss or joy. What this suggests to me is that the first thing out, you might say, of the Atman, the first thing out of the divine within, as it expresses itself in our separate individual self within this manifested world, is a separate joy, a kind of particular joy that underlies everything else. Because joy, as I said, is of the nature of consciousness, the Atman itself as Brahman, is Sat Chaitananda, being, knowledge, and joy or bliss. The Vedanta tradition, Brahman, the divine, is as characterized by infinite joy as by infinite being and infinite knowledge or wisdom. Next, after that, Vijnana, or sometimes Buddhi, the creative mind, the intuitive mind. Beyond that, Manas, in this tradition, the kind of ordinary functioning mind, problem-solving, memory, and so on. Beyond that, the prana, or the kind of not only emotional, but the whole kind of energy, life force, and so on, very much like the force in Star Wars. And beyond that, of course, is the physical body, the expression in form. So in the Vedanta tradition, we start out as a kind of separate joy. I would say in much traditional theosophy, this is kind of like the buddhi, sort of the link between the divine, the cosmic consciousness, which links the divine, but it also expresses itself within us as intuition and creativity and its ultimate source. And I would say, therefore, really enjoy, because one place in which we most feel joy, I think, is when we are truly creative, when we truly do something that has never been done by anyone else in that exact way before, when we suddenly flash on a connection, whether it's in writing and we see a new way to connect a couple of words, or in art, a new way to connect certain colors, engineering or science, different substances, and business and politics and so on, different forces or energies, or applications of money, you know, all of these things in the same way. When they are truly uniquely done, they are creative. They come ultimately, I think, from a kind of intuition. It has been said that genius is nothing more than putting two things together, or by extension more than two, but you may start with two that have never been put together in quite that way by anyone else before. And inevitably when this happens, you know, we have that kind of flash of joy, that kind of energy. And it's sort of like a breakthrough. I think we have it also in something like what Abraham Maslow called the peak experience. The peak experience, or the being state, be state. As far as I can tell, they're really the same thing, although in different places he used these different terms, is that kind of state where we feel completely fulfilled right in the present moment. It's kind of like, you know, if you play a musical instrument, a piano or something, you may spend a lot of time practicing a particular piece, and it may be hard work. But finally you come to that point where there's that sort of breakthrough, and it just begins to flow out. You no longer have to think, you know, now I put this finger here and now this one here and so on. But without thinking about it, it flows through you. You just do it. You probably play at that moment with more power, more expression than ever before. And inevitably, there'll be a kind of rush, a kind of feeling of joy at that time. And usually that will be sufficient to itself. One characteristic of this state of deep joy, being, peak experience, whatever you want to call it, is that you are not related to something outside of the present moment, but are fulfilled there. You're not thinking, well, I'm playing this piano and so on, but half an hour later I'm going to have to quit and go to the store, or I feel frustrated because I'm hungry or thirsty or tired or something like that. Those kind of thoughts are not there. So much of our life we really spend in a sort of suspended animation, I think, waiting for something big that's going to happen some other time, like sitting in the station or the airport, waiting for the train or the plane, and you can spend an awful lot of time in that. A lot of the planes in our life are seriously delayed. But if you instead are able to find deep joy right in the present moment where you are, then that's really what it's all about. It is a state that depends, is self-validating and in the present, as the psychologist would say, not dependent on something outside of the present. So all of those are characteristics of life when you really reach a peak or really find deep joy. And I think those are the times when you are most directly connected to the inner essence of life, whether you call it the Atman, the divine within, or what. Because it's sort of like you have set up a kind of a straight connection that goes from the present moment, even though it is in the outer manifested world, down through the various levels of our being. Theosophical levels use slightly different terminology, but I think are quite similar in principle, really, to the Vedanta, and connected all the way down to the Atman, the divine within, so that it's kind of like the pipelines are open, all of the taps are released, and the energy flows up and down all the way through. Too often that is diverted because our focus is outside the present, not to mention away from that which is our true nature within, toward things that we are either afraid of or desire or are angry at or whatever outside. So, in short, another idea that was very important to me in preparing this study was the idea of joy, ananda, as being really our innermost nature. And so it is always there. And I found myself, this a very inspiring thought, you know, that whatever goes on outside, whatever there is, like those clouds getting in front of the sun, like the sun is always there, the deep joy is always there. It's just a matter of getting connected to it. Now, how do you connect to it? How do you live in joy? Or is this just a kind of ideal? Well, of course, in a real sense, it's an ideal. I would not pretend that I am always in the state that is described in this book. In fact, far from it. In fact, I would even say that when I was writing this book, I often had a feeling that I was writing stuff that I was really not worthy to write. You know, I was saying things that maybe gave a much more exalted impression of my own saintliness and joy and so on than I knew as well or better than anyone was the case. But it was almost like it was something that was coming through me. I don't mean that in any sort of psychic sense of channeling or anything like that at all. But that it was something that I was, was coming from some part of me or something somewhere that wasn't my everyday conscious mind, but which I needed as much as anybody else, if not more so. That I was writing it for myself even more than anybody else. And that therefore, you know, I knew that the message was coming to me too. The deep joy is there. You have to go and look for it until you find it. You have to find out how to access it in your own life. If not all the time, at least more and more. How do you do that? Well, I've already mentioned meditation, and I think that meditation or prayer, you know, whatever is most congenial to one's own religious tradition, is very important. If only because that is stopping the ordinary activity of mind so that your consciousness goes into a different place than the ordinary reactive problem-solving, remembering kind of mind that ordinarily operates and usually operates on the basis of a strong interaction either with what's going on outside of you. You know, I like this person, I don't like this person, I like what's going on, I don't like what's going on, this makes me angry, this makes me fearful, this makes me covetous of wanting something over here, and, just back and forth, maybe on an intense level, maybe on a low-key level a lot of the time, but just the ordinary chatter, both external and internal, of life in this world. And as I said before, if there's nothing going on outside to stimulate it, you can certainly find plenty of it within as the memory dredges up things from the past that you can gnaw on and worry about. But the idea of prayer or meditation is to put a stop to that. In the East, they talk about one-pointed meditation. One-pointed meditation simply means focusing on one point, on one particular thing, as a means of stopping this stream of consciousness, building a dam to it right here. I'm sure most of you know something about the many different techniques of meditation, whether it's using a mantra that you externally or internally chant, or focusing on a candle flame or a religious symbol, if that's significant to you, or whatever. Or it may be an internal kind of focus, counting the breaths as they do in Zen, focusing on something that you image within your mind, the blue flame or whatever. The whole idea of all of these is really the same, so it doesn't matter too much what particular focus you use. It is to bring the mind against that focus in order to stop the ongoing stream of consciousness. The idea is if you can stop it right here, then you stop the stream. Maybe sooner or later you can even take away that one focus and have left the void or God. And the value of that, from the deep joy point of view at least, is that by stopping this ordinary rise and fall of the external waves, you have like plunged down into the still depths. You have put the mind in a place where there are no distractions, at least, to the rising of the deep joy. But there are other aspects of finding deep joy in our lives, too. Another one is to think of our life as a series of initiations. We talk a lot about initiation in theosophy, and rightly so, because nothing is more important and real to our lives, at least in my view, than that we are continually preparing for or undergoing or living in the aftermath of initiations. What is an initiation? Well, basically, I think of it as an experience which, from there on out, completely, or not completely, but significantly changes the conditions of your life, including the conditions of that are at the foundation of your consciousness, of how you think, of how you respond to things. The usual analogy for initiation, in fact, is death and rebirth, dying to one thing in order to be born to something else. In certain religions, they talk a lot about being born again or passing through a death and rebirth experience. And I think rightly so, because whether you call it that or not, we all pass through a lot of experiences like this. Begin with our physical birth itself. Certainly for the child as a fetus in the womb, passing through the birth canal, being born into this world, must certainly seem like a kind of death. You know, the fetus is leaving everything that is familiar to it, the darkness, the warmth, the comfort, the automatic feeding, everything in the womb, and being forced, really against its will, down through a narrow, often no doubt painful and certainly traumatic passageway, into a glaring light that is something like it's never seen before. It must seem like a kind of stabbing. No wonder it usually cries. And it certainly must seem, if it could formulate such ideas consciously, that this must be death. And yet we on our side say, hooray, a child is born into the world. And we think it is a joyous and wonderful thing. Hopefully, sooner or later, it will be for the child itself. But it's a powerful experience, a tremendous transition, dying to one thing, being born to something else. And we go through this again and again. All of us that have been through the traumas of puberty and adolescence, you'll know that that is certainly a dying to one thing, the life of the child, its so-called innocence, and being born to a whole different way of being in the world, sexual, emotional, in far deeper and more powerful ways than ever before. So many new kinds of problems to solve, so many new intellectual possibilities, and also things to greatly fear. You know, all of this is certainly like another kind of death to one thing, birth to another. One could go on with the passage then from adolescence into adulthood, dying to the life of the student or the teenager and being born to the responsibilities of adult life. Along with this, sooner or later, often going marriage, parenthood, the rest of it, which are initiations in themselves. And alongside of that, sooner or later, there will come initiations like serious, even life-threatening sickness. Any of you that have been through a serious illness of one kind or another, you know, must be well aware that you are never really the same afterwards. You look at your life differently. You think about your life differently. You have different kinds of ideas about the fragility and perhaps also the preciousness of life than before. And finally, of course, death itself to this world. And I think in the view of most of us, it is, in another sense, a birth. I need hardly add that virtually all societies in the world have kind of ceremonial, ritual practices to accompany most all of these major initiations. And these are very significant because basically what they do is, A, point out that they are common to all human beings. Secondly, to point out that they have social significance as well as individual significance. You know, for birth, we have things like baptism, bar mitzvah, and so on. Usually, there is a religious practice surrounding, I should have said circumcision in the first instance, but for the passage into puberty and adolescence, things like bar mitzvah, baptism, the samskaras in Hinduism, and so on. Virtually all societies have some sort of way of recognizing marriage, of recognizing parenthood in ceremonial ways to indicate that this is, again, not significant only for the person, but for the society as a whole. It's important to the society as a whole for a person to have a name, which is usually given at baptism and the other birth ceremonies. To have a status in society of passing from childhood to youth and adulthood in the adolescent ceremony, that marriage is certainly a social thing involving the whole community, that these two people are together in a special way and are going to have a family, presumably, and so it goes. And finally, of course, there are the individual initiations on another level, which may be more personal. These two can be given by communities like special religious initiations of a shaman or entering a or passing through the mysteries or entering a religious community or order in a special way. They also can be entirely inward. The Asavas talk about initiations by persons who in dreams or out of the body go to receive initiations from the masters in Shambhala, and like so on. For many people, conversion experiences, often very powerful, deep mystical experiences, have certainly served, and rightly so, as initiations, a passage from one kind of life to another, from one way of being spiritually to another way, undoubtedly is far profounder and deeper. But I mentioned that in the first of these initiations, it seems like a kind of death. But on the other hand, we say, hooray, a child is born into the world, and if all goes well, the child sooner or later must be rejoicing, profoundly enthusiastic about all the new things that are being discovered. A baby, you know, loves to reach out, to touch, to feel things, to see as its eyes gradually focus so that it sees the world around it in some kind of proportionate way, perhaps beginning with the mother and going on from there. And that, I think, is true of all of these initiations, that they all can be very, very difficult, painful. And yet, there is something to rejoice about because what they have done ultimately is to expand, to open up in even wider dimensions our capacity for appreciation, for seeing, for knowing, and therefore for deep joy. The child's way of seeing the world is certainly wonderful. And in many respects, much is lost when we pass from childhood into adulthood and perhaps see it with more jaded eyes. And yet there are things that an adult can understand and appreciate, which a child cannot. Dimensions of depth. Dimensions of depth in relationships through love with others, through a family of your own, through knowledge and learning that we can acquire. And we know that until we have passed through that initiation or series of initiations, that we can hardly even explain it to the child any more than probably the masters can fully explain to us what our life is really all about, even as adults in this world at this present stage of our pilgrimage. Children often want to know what it's like being an adult. They even want to try it out sometime. That's why they like to dress up in their mother and father's clothes and shoes and things like that. But we know that, although that's wonderful, there are some things that we simply cannot tell them as a child in words that they will have to grow into. And that's a characteristic of all initiations. It imparts knowledge, wisdom, that cannot just be told in words, but somehow has to be experienced or grown into through a change in yourself, in your not only your mind, but also your feelings, your ways of reacting, your inner nature all the way down can be transformed by truly effective initiation. So initiations, then, finally I'm saying, are also initiations into deep joy. Meditation can do it, but we need to recognize also that if we pass through the initiations that life presents to us, and it will certainly present many, many initiations to all of us. Some of them the same as other people. Some of them may be different to some degree to each of us individually in the way we go through them. Each of us will have our individual experiences, no doubt, with sickness, with problems in relationship, with sorrows of losing loved ones, all of the other things. But whatever it is, initiations tell us that if we go through them well, effectively, if we are open to what they have to teach and we learn, we will ultimately come out on the other side with an enhanced capacity for deep joy, simply because new avenues for the reception of joy in the universe have been opened to us. So another way of learning how to live with deep joy is learning how to undergo initiation. I have some other things in the book along similar lines, you know, things about our lifestyles for initiations, rather for deep joy. I think it comports best in brief with living a life that is neither in extreme poverty or extreme opulence, both of which can be distractions from the really important things of life, which above all is love and joy. It should be, at least suggest a kind of simple but comfortable life, perhaps surrounded by art that you or your friends have largely created for yourselves with a few good books and music and things like that. But these are things that one needs to explore for oneself. In conclusion, then, to what I have to say anyway, let me talk, or rather read a little bit from the very end of the book to sort of give an idea where it's going to. It kind of recapitulates first by saying, deep, deathless joy is the innermost reality of the universe and of ourselves as sons and daughters of that universe. It's God's in the making. Joy is our heritage, and we can claim it today. Some may hold that a gift as exalted as deep joy cannot be forced or claimed. It can only come on its own when the time is right. Right, rather. Or maybe ripe too. And certainly there are those who would say that joy is such a gift of God's grace or good karma or whatever that you can't reach out and grab it. It can only come on its own. I think there is we're getting into an area where I think our words and concepts are almost fail us. Certainly there is a sense in which when deep joy comes, it seems unearned, undeserved, that it was simply given to us as a gift, which is what grace or gratia really means in this context. Yet at the same time, there are ways in which maybe the expression would be that we can prepare ourselves well to receive this gift when it's available, when it comes. In fact, I'd here go on to say joy is ours by right, and that is simply because I think it is our innermost nature. And therefore, it is something that we find within ourselves, not from somewhere else. And to that sense, it's our right to have it because it's already ours. Joy is ours by right, and we are empowered to take charge of our lives. Eternity's gifts belong to any and all points in time. The teachings of all religions regarding prayer and meditation indicate that we are to lay hold of divine gifts, not to insult heaven by scorning them. You can start today, then, to reach for the gift of deep joy. Sit down and think about your life. When do you know joy? Perhaps you even haven't even exactly done an inventory to realize when you most know joy and when it seems to be most blocked in your case. You just sort of go on moment by moment. When do you know joy and what seems to block it at other times? First, the negatives. What can be done about the blockages? Should you make any change in your attitude, in your lifestyle, in what you are doing with your life? Even more importantly, think about the positives, the places in your life where seeds of deep joy are already planted. Whether they are in the jubilant way you respond to nature, to sports, to children, to your present religion, or even to the challenges of work, doesn't matter. They represent sources of growth toward greater joy that you can nourish. They can spark your spiritual awakening. Cultivate those seeds, and from them let grow the vine of the spiritual way and the fruit of union with universal joy. In other words, just think about, when you seem to be, as it were, naturally the most joyous. What are the things that really give you joy? And certainly you have the right to look at those, to isolate them, to help them to flourish and grow. Nourish them as you would a flower with water and fertilizer and careful cultivation and so on. Because I'm quite convinced that anything that really and truly gives you deep joy, not just a happiness or pleasure, but deep joy is good, is what is right for you to develop. Doesn't make any difference whether it's the same as somebody else or not. We can't live other people's lives, we can only live our own. Live our own on the deepest level by making it as joyous as possible. I'm quite convinced, as I say in the book, that a person who really has deep joy will live the right kind of life. That you don't have deep joy and do criminal or abusive things or any that sort of thing at the same time. All of that, I think, really comes out of the blockage of deep joy. People trying to find surrogates for joy in things that are really destructive to themselves or others. Drugs or drink or tobacco or abuse of others or excessive preoccupation with getting ahead, making money, all of that. These are all kind of things that we do because we don't know any other way to be joyful. But if we can find the deep joy that is already there, that doesn't have to depend on all of that, then we will be freed from those things and instead out of joy, I think naturally comes a capacity to love other people more deeply and effectively, not only romantic love, but the kind of love that we can extend to everyone with a helping hand and a friendly smile, and doing what we can to alleviate the suffering of the world, both human and animal. So I think there is nothing wrong, in fact, everything right, with finding and cultivating your own inner sources of joy, and also finding the negatives, that which blocks it, and getting them out of the way. Even if it means some serious changes in your life. I'd even make bold to say that if there is anyone here who finds that the theosophy gives you more unhappiness than it does joy, then you ought to get rid of it and go somewhere else. Because your calling is to find whatever really most develops deep joy within yourself. I go on to add that finally, remember the awakening stage. I talk about different stages of the spiritual life, and I won't go into that here, but that at the beginning of a spiritual life, there can be a kind of roller coaster effect because it is pretty much tied to the emotions at the beginning. People that have, as many teenagers and others do, powerful religious experiences, conversion, born again, mystical, and so on, we'll often find that maybe a few hours or a few days later, that kind of wears off and you have a sort of numbness in its place. And you may think, gosh, I must have committed some great sin, or maybe it was all just an illusion, because that feeling that I had then, I no longer have. But that's natural, because when it's tied to emotions, or emotions always come and go, rise and fall. That's their nature, at least in a reasonably healthy person. If you are only on one emotion all the time, like somebody who's always depressed or always giddy and manic, that's a sign of very serious mental problem, and you certainly need competent help. But for most of us, we find that no emotion lasts forever on the emotional level. You're angry, sooner or later it wears off. You're joyous about something, and sooner, in the sense of being happy about a success or a love or that sort of thing, and sooner or later it kind of wears off. Even if you're in deep sorrow over the loss of someone that you loved, you may find sooner or later that the sorrow kind of turns to a sort of numbness where you simply don't seem to be able to feel much of anything anymore. All of this can bother people, but I think that's because of a misunderstanding that this is on the level of the emotions, and the emotions always sort of go through cycles and change. Deep joy, may have some expression on this level, but of its own nature, it is much further down within, like the still small voice. The great mystics talk about it not as emotional feeling, but as a very, very deep, almost unrecognized, and yet somehow there, kind of inner peace, inner calm, inner joy in the midst of whatever happens. So we want to try to get on that level instead of on the emotional roller coaster level. So it ends by saying, in time you may know deep joy on the wonderful level of illumination. If your wisdom deepens with your joy and you learn to let nothing get you down, finally you will come to know the deepest secret of the universe itself, which is the joy as part of the being, knowledge, and joy or bliss of the divine. Well, I think I'll stop here and see if there are any comments or questions that anybody has. Yes?
Robert, you did not use the word contentment at all.
Uh-huh.
Isn't that synonymous with joy?
Well, in part it is, because, language is always symbolic. It's not the thing. And words like that may even have different associations or meaning from different people. I guess for me, I would think of contentment as being analogous to joy, but not quite on the same level. You know, it's more like an even keel of consciousness, which is certainly better than going into deep valleys and so on, but is not also not quite the same as being on the mountaintops either. You know, it's not, there's to what I would think of as deep joy, there is a kind of a little stronger feeling than I just have with contentment, you know, and I don't mean that it's a giddy emotional kind of feeling either, as I was just talking, but it's a more positive kind of sense of vigor, of zest, enthusiasm, you know, that comes along with it than simply being content. But as I said, I think that's, you know, probably gets into words that may have different connotations for different people, so you can only go so far with it.
I had the sense that contentment is a feeling, and joy can be a feeling, but I had the sense that you meant it not as a feeling, but as a way of being, one of being joy,
mm-hmm.
feeling joy.
Yes, I think you're right. There again, I think we're sort of getting to the limits of language, but I do, it is something that you know is there, and yet it's not an emotion in a way that's analogous to emotions of fear, anger, or the more giddy kind of happiness, I guess. David?
That's joy is far more active than contentment.
Uh-huh. I think it motivates you to be active, yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you want to be creative, you want to do something when you have that kind of inner joy. Yeah, Vance?
For the most part, you think joy from the inside out, or from the outside in, or a combination of those?
Well, I think it for us it comes from the inside out, in the sense that it's something that is in our own true nature that we get in touch with, not something that is produced by outside things in this present life and in this present world, like happiness. Of course, I suppose in another sense it does come from the outside, in that it ultimately comes from the universe, from the divine within the universe as a whole. But as I said, we are part of that universe, and so, you know, whatever is out there is also within us, and vice versa. But I do think there is a way in which you get a kind of a sense of connectedness with the deep joy of the universe, too, if you're really into this. Thank you, and may you all find joy.